What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casuals and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Welcome to Business on the Brink, a production from iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. Invention doesn't always go as planned. Sometimes you get unpredictable results.
But rather than stick to the original plan, a wise business owner might cast about for a new strategy.
And before you know it, you've got a success on your hands.
This is a series of accidental inventions on Business on the Brink.
Hey everyone, I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Ariel Kasten.
And this episode was sort of done as a whim.
A whim?
A whim. Yeah, I had been thinking about incidents where someone has come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. And they have they've got an actual implementation in mind for that idea. But it turns out whatever that implementation was doesn't work out. And in most cases, if that happened, you'd say, well, that's a failed invention. That was a failed experiment. Yeah, exactly. Like, well, you learn more from failure than you do from success. Got to try something else. But occasionally, people are able to take that failure or that miscalculation and then reposition it to become a success. That became the genesis for this episode. And there's some stuff, I mean, there's a lot of things we could have covered. We're only going to look at three specific products in this episode.
Yes.
But one of the ones that I was going to mention that we don't cover in this episode, just as an example, is the Super Soaker water guns. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with these,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we love these things. They came out when I was still young enough to be able to play with water guns without raising suspicions.
I still play with water guns.
I know, but you're also younger than I am by a decade. So the Super Soaker was actually invented by a guy who was working on a water pump for, like, water heaters. And turned out he figured out how to use that for a water gun, and it became a huge deal. That story is its own dramatic up and down story, yeah, that we may cover in a future episode.
But the things we're covering here are smaller.
Yeah. Smaller in size, but not necessarily smaller in success. Although some you may say never made as big a splash, so to speak, as a Super Soaker.
Jonathan.
But they've been around longer. So yeah, we're going to talk about some creative ideas and creative individuals who were able to take things that initially didn't go as planned and turn them into successes. And the first on our list is...
Drumroll.
Let me shake this and see. It says, answer unclear. Ask again later. What could that mean?
It means that you're holding an imaginary magic eight ball in your hands, Jonathan.
Okay, yeah, but you're way to break the illusion. It's an audio podcast. They never know. Yes, we're going to talk about the magic eight ball. And one thing that I found very fascinating, these were things that I just sort of... looked around and found a couple of these. It surprised me. And the Magic 8 Ball was one of them. You think of the Magic 8 Ball as just kind of a fun little diversion, right?
Yeah. A toy by people who are inspired by Ouija boards and
Kind of thing. Yeah. And the Ouija board also is a toy, by the way. It was created by a board game company. But the 8 Ball has its history wrapped up with the history of mysticism, of seances and clairvoyance, because the inventor of the Magic 8 Ball, or at least a co-inventor, was Al Carter. And I call him Al because in about half of the references about the origins of the Magic 8 Ball, his name is given as Albert, and in the other half, it's given as Alfred.
And Albertafred.
Yeah. So we're just calling him Al, like, okay, kind of like Chevy Chase and Paul Simon.
All right. But it says here that the first 8 Ball that Al created wasn't even a ball.
No, it wasn't a ball. It certainly wasn't an 8 Ball. So his mom worked as a clairvoyant and a mystic, so essentially a medium or a fortune teller. And he was inspired by this to create a device, a gimmick, you might say. If you were a magician, you would call it a gimmick. Mm-hmm. And it was a thing to use sort of as a fortune-telling device. And he came up with this concept that he called the psycho-seer. Psycho is spelled S-Y-C-O. And this would be in the 1940s. And this did not look like a Magic 8 Ball, although it had the same purpose. So it looked kind of like, imagine a soda can, mm-hmm, but it's taller than a soda can.
So like one of the new Diet Coke cans.
Sure. And it's narrower than a standard Coke can, right?
All right.
Now I'm calling it Coke. Like, you can tell I'm from Atlanta because all soft drinks become Coke eventually.
All right.
But then the ends of the cylinder are clear, like little clear windows. So instead of a solid top and a solid bottom, it's still solid, but now it's clear, like acrylic. Mm-hmm. On the inside, he had a very dark, syrupy liquid. A lot of sources say it was essentially molasses. It was apparently divided in the middle, so it was actually two containers in one form factor.
That
and there
makes
was
sense.
A die on either one.
Well, because you could put smaller canisters on either end of it and not have to fill the entire tube necessarily.
Yes. And you had a die with things written on the faces of the die, very much like you would with a Magic 8 Ball. So you'd ask yes or no questions, give it a little bit of shake, turn it up so that one of the windows is facing up, wait for one of those die to slowly rise to the surface of some thick old molasses.
Mm. If you break it, you get a snack.
That's true. A nice sweet tooth there. And then you get to read the message on there and find the answer to your yes or no question.
Was one of his messages when he was designing this, go talk and get a partner?
No, but that is what he did. So it would have been a very predictive message had that been the case. He decided that he couldn't just go out there with this idea on his own. He lacked the resources to make it as a big product.
This is going to be kind of a common theme throughout all of the stories we're telling in this episode.
Yeah, and it's something that you run into a lot when you're talking about inventors. I mean, most of the time, the people who are inventing something don't necessarily have access to, say, a manufacturing facility.
Yeah.
And that was the case here. So depending upon the version of the story that you read, he either went to his cousin, Abe Bookman, or his brother-in-law, Abe Bookman, or he went to a merchant named Max Levinson who had a brother-in-law named Abe Bookman.
I mean, I guess technically all three could be correct.
That's creepy, but he went to a guy named Abe Bookman who had graduated from essentially an engineering school, the Ohio Mechanics Institute. And this was with the hope that Bookman would help him come up with a way to mass manufacture the psycho-seer. And so the two of them went into business together, and they created their own company called Alabe Crafts. And Alabe is a combination of the names Al and Abe.
That's very clever.
Yes. So sometime in that early partnership, Al Carter passed away. Ironically, he didn't see it coming.
Jonathan.
Yeah?
Jonathan.
What?
just
it's a serious thing that I shouldn't joke about.
No, but I mean,
yes, but time,
yes,
time,
but no.
Time in comedy, you know.
Yeah. All right. Anyhow, so this wasn't the end of the Magic 8 Ball. Abe Bookman continued on, right?
Yes, exactly. So even though Carter had patented this idea, the name of the patent was really funny too. Is like very. If you've ever read titles of patents, you see that they're very technically describing whatever it is the invention does. They don't give like a name like that. Anyway, he did patent it, and so Bookman still continued forward with the design. He ended up making a shorter version of the Psycho-Seer. It was so about half the height of the original cylinder. It's still in cylinder form.
So it wasn't more short-sighted.
I mean, it wasn't more long-sighted. It was just as sighted, I guess, is what we can say. But it was about half the size of the Psycho-Seer, and it only had one side of the cylinder with a window in it. The other side was solid, and it was called the Psycho-Slate instead of the Psycho-Seer.
I wouldn't think of a slate as something I could shake and get a fortune out of.
Well, here's another interesting fact that I didn't include in our notes, but apparently, Al Carter, when he was first thinking about this, he was inspired by something his mother used to do, which is that she would take a slate, like a blackboard slate, and some chalk, and the slate would have nothing written on it, and she would have the chalk, and she would put it out of sight, like in a container of some sort, and she would have her clients ask a question, and then she would open up the container, and the answer would be written on the slate.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, here's the interesting thing is that that's an old style stage magic trick.
It is. I've seen it on Penn and Teller.
Yes, Penn and Teller are famous for doing tricks very much in this very same style. And the argument goes, and this is a very solid argument, if there is a non-magical way to do it, chances are that's how it was done. Because why go through the trouble of doing it a magical way, which is, as far as we know, impossible.
When you can do it an ordinary way.
Exactly. But if you play it up with a lot of theatrics, you can make it seem like it's mystical. So he got the idea from his mom. So Psycho Slate, in a way, is almost a throwback to the original inspiration for this device.
Interesting.
Now, Bookman was able to make these in larger volume than the Psycho Seer, but it didn't exactly take off.
I mean, obviously, we don't have it today. We have the Magic 8 Ball.
Yeah.
So how do we go from a slate to a ball?
So first it was Bookman saying, you know, these just aren't going off store shelves. I guess there are not a lot of mediums at large.
I would flip this table if I could. No, I like your puns.
And you've got your cup of water.
I got
you don't
cup
wanna.
Of water.
So, yes, there was not a huge demand for the Psycho Slate. So he thought, well, maybe I'll change up the form factor a bit more and have something that appeals to that same set of people. And so he decided, I'll make a crystal ball version where the cylinder is essentially nestled in the crystal ball. It'll be a dark crystal ball, so it's not like it's clear acrylic or something, and you'll still turn it over to read the little message on the window, the clear window that's in this crystal ball. And so he started making those. And these also weren't going like gangbusters, but they did get the attention of a Chicago company called Brunswick Billiards. Billiards as in pool tables. With a capital P, that rhymes with T.
That rhymes with trouble.
Yeah, that doesn't rhyme with trouble, but it starts.
No, I know. I know. Anyhow, so he must have been the one who said, hey, let's take these and turn them into billiard balls.
Yeah, well, the billiards company did. They came up to Bookman.
Brunswick Billiards.
Yeah, exactly. They came up to Bookman. They said, we want to do a promotional item. Essentially, it was a giveaway. And we like this thing you've created. Can you make some that look like eight balls from the game of pool? And Bookman said, you betcha. And he went about making eight ball versions of this fortune teller's crystal ball. And the giveaways were incredibly popular. People loved the Magic 8 Ball.
And people love free things.
People also love free things. That remains true to this very day. This, by the way, is still happening in the like early 50s at this point.
All right.
Bookman decides after this agreement has concluded with Brunswick Billiards that he would continue making eight balls as a variation of this crystal ball one that he had been making. And he starts kind of giving up a little bit. He starts selling them as paperweights because he can't really think of, like—
People aren't buying them as much as they were enjoying getting them.
Yeah, they weren't. There just wasn't a market of people who were like, I want to consult the spirits of beyond, but I just don't know how to get into that racket.
So that's when Bookman thought, hey, I'll market these to kids. Kids will fall for anything.
Pretty much. He saw that kids were playing with these paperweights and really having a fun time with them. And he thought, well, maybe that's just it. It's not that the product is bad.
I'm marketing to the wrong audience.
Exactly. And so he decides he will market it as a toy. And he starts to do that. And now it actually is starting to take off. And again, it was an unpredictable result. But by 1971, Bookman was ready to retire from this business. So he sold the company, Alabe Crafts, which had been around for 20 years at that, more than 20 years, almost 30 years at that point.
Respectable.
Sold it to a company called the Ideal Toy Company. That's another company we could do a full episode on.
They mainly were known for doing like doll
yes,
type stuff.
They were very much in the doll biz. I think Betsy Wetsy was one of their dolls.
Betsy Wetsy.
Yep. And in 1971, the same year when Ideal Toy Company would acquire Alabe Crafts, it joined the New York Stock Exchange. At the time, it was one of the largest toy companies in the United States.
Well, they also had toys like the Rubik's Cube.
Yep. They were the ones that made the Rubik's Cube famous in the 80s. So that was from the Ideal Toy Company. By the later part of the 80s, mid to later part of the 80s, the company was really starting to struggle. There was a recession. There were some bad business decisions that led to some financial troubles for Ideal Toy. And so CBS Toys, which was a subsidiary of
CBS.
Yep. CBS, the broadcasting company, ended up purchasing Ideal Toy, and Magic 8-Ball went along with it, in 1982 for $58 million. So now Ideal Toy becomes part of CBS Toys, but that would only last for a little while because CBS would then sell Ideal Toy to another company called Viewmaster International. You know Viewmaster.
I owned a Viewmaster.
Okay, I didn't know. So Viewmaster are those ones that look kind of like binoculars. You put in a disc that has different photographs in it. It has the stereo vision kind of lenses,
yeah.
So it gives you that sort of 3D effect.
You can get like a 3D.
Yeah, and you just click through and it's like a slide projector.
And then if you click halfway, then you just try to get these really weird images.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
That becomes the Viewmaster Ideal Company. 1989 rolls around, then you get Tyco Toys, which announces that it would acquire Viewmaster Ideal for about $44 million.
So less than the last acquisition, mm-hmm. But not bad.
Not bad. And it also meant that the Magic 8-Ball would go to Tyco Toys, which was famous for other types of toys like the Easy Bake Oven.
Mm-hmm.
So very, very popular, or Tasty Bake Oven, I should say, not
but
Easy Bake.
They did not start putting molasses back into the 8-Balls.
No, no. At this point, it was rubbing alcohol with blue dye.
Yeah.
That was the liquid.
But they weren't done yet.
No. 1996, Mattel, another giant in the toy industry, swoops in to acquire Tyco for $755 million.
Well, I mean, Tyco was a bigger company. They had a lot more toys.
Exactly. Tyco was huge. Now, that meant that the Magic 8-Ball went with Mattel. And along that whole process, the Magic 8-Ball continued to be a product sold on the market. So even though ownership was changing hands multiple times, the product itself continued to do pretty well. It was, you know, it wasn't like it was flying off store shelves in particular years, but it was a steady seller.
I mean, by 2012, they had sold a million of them.
A year.
Yeah.
A million a year.
That's a lot.
That's pretty decent. And now these days, you can find Magic 8-Balls in all sorts of sizes, from the regular size, which is definitely larger than an actual billiard ball, to keychain versions. You can find a bunch of them that are licensed. I've got a Simpsons one, which has Simpsons phrases in there, like dough instead of no. So there are definitely variations on the Magic 8-Ball. It's interesting. So I have the notes here.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to ask you, Ariel, the questions, and you can tell people what the answers are. How many sides does the die inside a Magic 8 Ball have?
20.
Yes. So it's essentially like a Dungeons and Dragons dice that you use for attacks.
I was going to say, a bookman must have been a secret Dungeons and Dragons player. No. It's just so that they could have a lot of sides with the answer yes, 10 of them, a lot with no, 5 of them, and then 5 more that said maybe.
Yes.
So you weren't just shaking like you can't have a 3-sided dice. So.
Yeah, no. The best you could do is a 4-sided
so this
or a coin.
This way, it made your chances more random.
Right. Well, and also meant that you were twice as likely to get a yes as you were a no.
Or a maybe.
Or a maybe. And it's funny because I was looking at a statistics site and it said, statistically speaking, you would need to ask 72 questions at least to see all 20 possible answers just based on probability. That would be the bare minimum you would need to do based on probability alone. Now, it is entirely possible to ask 20 questions and then get each answer in sequence. It's just not likely to happen.
So you've got a note here says, will that happen every 72 times? Ask again later.
Ask again later.
Now, you don't have on here that they have ask again later.
That's true.
Unless it's a maybe response.
That's a maybe. It's on there kind of like answer unclear, ask again later. That's a maybe. So it's not an outright yes or no. And again, like the licensed versions have different variations for positive and negative. Yeah. But yeah, that's to me, that's an interesting story about an item that originally was marketed more seriously, if you can think of it that way, or at least more earnestly as a fortune-telling device, and then it ultimately became a novelty/toy, and that's where it found its success.
I'm very excited to get into our next story, but first let's take a quick break.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. oracle.com/strategic.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, Ariel.
Yeah?
Let's talk about rubber for a minute.
It's pretty useful.
It is. It's incredibly useful stuff. I mean, here's the stuff about rubber that makes it useful, right? It's really resilient. It resists damage pretty well. It's waterproof material. It's stretchy. It's flexible. It is used in tons of stuff, including, and this is important, stuff like tires and boots.
Yeah, but you know what? It's not easy to get rubber, right?
Not natural rubber, no.
No, not natural rubber, because it comes out of trees.
Yes.
And specifically, trees that largely are in Asia.
Yes.
So, like, largely a specific region. And to get it, you have to, like, cut into the tree and collect sap like you're getting maple syrup.
Yep.
And that it has latex in it, and then you refine it, and then that makes rubber.
Yes. So it's a whole process. And then you have to, of course, ship it from wherever you're harvesting it to wherever you want it to go to use in whatever materials. So rubber, everyone recognized that rubber was useful stuff, but it was just, it was hard to get a lot of it at once. So starting even as early as the 1800s, you had scientists who were saying, this is definitely useful, but we need to figure out a different way to make it. And so people started to work on formulas to create synthetic rubber.
Okay, but you know what? I don't want to start in the 1800s. Skip ahead, Jonathan.
Okay, all right. Well, how about World War II?
Okay.
Is that better?
That's better.
Because that's going to get to the beginning of where we're going to here. World War II, obviously the U.S. military has a huge need for rubber, for stuff like tires and boots, like I'd mentioned a second ago. And on top of that, in World War II, one of the powers that the United States was up against was Japan, which had already attacked or was threatening regions where natural rubber was coming from. So there was a clear need to develop synthetic rubber. And not only that, it needed to be synthetic rubber that came from materials that were easy to get to in wartime. So that meant that the U.S. had to say, who out there can help us do this stuff?
So who did?
Well, there are a couple different versions of this story. There was actually a lot of people working on this problem. And at least two different groups came up with a similar possible solution that ended up not being a solution to the synthetic rubber problem. Spoiler alert. One of those groups was Earl Warwick and Rob Roy McGregor, who worked at Corning Glassworks. And they took boric oxide and silicone oil, mixed it together, and they found that it made this stretchy, bouncy material stuff, which they filed for a patent in the early 40s, and they got the patent in 1947. The other version has a guy named James Wright, who was an engineer at General Electric. This is the version of the story that most people tell for the material we're about to cover.
Well, it's more fun.
Yeah, it is more fun. He got the assignment to try and create cheap synthetic rubber, and he dropped some silicone oil in boric acid, so very similar. He got that same sort of gooey substance. Discovered that it had some interesting properties. It bounced. You could, you know, roll it into a ball and bounce it against the ground. If you hit it hard enough, it would shatter. You could stretch it. You could even press it against newsprint and pick the newsprint up off the paper.
But you know what you can't do?
What's that?
Replace rubber.
Yeah.
So because you can't use it for as a replacement for rubber, the military was not interested in it.
Yeah. They said, thanks, but we need something that'll work in tires. And this wouldn't, even if the only thing we were driving across was newspaper. So no, thank you.
Yeah.
So at that stage, again, you could say, well, shucks, that didn't work out. And you could move on. Or you could try and do what Wright tried to do, which was to market it as a commercial product.
I mean, he was having fun with it.
Yeah.
He found a whole bunch of interesting things you could do with it. My favorite is the shattering it.
My favorite is picking up newsprint because
I used to do that too.
Comic strips.
And when he tried to market it commercially, he called it Nutty Putty.
But obviously, you guys out there have figured out what this substance must have been. And Nutty Putty is not what we call it. But so we'll skip ahead again. There are a couple different conflicting stories about what happens next. No big surprise. We've already got these branching narratives that have happened. But in one version, you have a guy named Peter Hodgson, who was at a party in 1949.
Woo, party!
And he was an ad man, worked in the magazine trade and catalogs and stuff like that. And according to some stories, he was out of work at that time. And the main entertainment at that party was people playing with Wright's Nutty Putty, which sounds way worse when I say it out loud than it did when I wrote it down.
Yeah, it definitely sounds worse orally than on the page.
Yes, I think we can agree. It sounds worse orally.
Anyhow, he saw that people were really amused with this putty, and he was like, hey, this could be a successful toy.
Yeah, and he ended up deciding that he could use his marketing skill coupled with this amazing stuff, and that would be the key to success. Now, the other version of this story says Hodgson was actually working on a catalog for a toy store that was owned by a woman named Ruth Fallgatter, and they found out about the putty when Hodgson was visiting a Harvard physicist who had some of the stuff. There's another version that says both Hodgson and Fallgatter were at that same party where people were passing stuff around. It's hard to say who is telling the most accurate story here, but no matter what, they decided to go to GE and to get the production rights to make this stuff. And GE said,
sure, we don't know what to do with it. Go ahead.
Yeah, they had no use for it. So Hodgson got the rights to Nutty Putty. And he started making it, and he would sell it for $2 per unit or glob or wad of the stuff.
Ball.
Yeah. And it sold really well inside Fall Gatter's catalog. She marketed it in the catalog for her toy store.
Yeah, it sold better than everything but crayons.
Yes, there was a box of crayons for 50 cents that was the top seller, and the second top seller was this Nutty Putty stuff.
But then Fall Gatter decided to stop selling it.
Yeah.
I don't know why, if it was selling so well.
She didn't have the putty passion, is what we say in the business.
I see. I follow you, Jonathan.
She felt petty about the putty.
All right. Anyhow, Hodgson took out a loan and bought a big batch of the stuff and rebranded it as Silly Putty.
Yes. Yes. And that is when another idea occurred to him, because at the time where he was launching this secondary attack here, the launch date was really close to Easter. And that's when he thought, hey, you know what I could package this stuff in?
Chocolate Easter bunnies.
Might have been his first thought, but he did not go with that one. He thought plastic eggs. And that's where the Silly Putty in a plastic egg package comes from. And he started selling it for $1 per egg. And what really helped him was not the fact that folks were finding it so fascinating, but rather a certain magazine published a short passage about the stuff, and that got it into the public consciousness. That magazine was The New Yorker.
That's impressive.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's known for two things: launching Silly Putty and cartoons that nobody's really sure if they're funny or not.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can use your Silly Putty to pull those cartoons right off The New Yorker. You'd be fine.
So if you look at it twice, maybe you can figure out.
Yeah, twice and backwards.
If it is funny.
Yeah. So then Hodgson ends up making television commercials for it. Some of the earliest TV commercials aimed at children were for Silly Putty. The earliest was for a different toy. Do you know which toy it was?
Mr. Potato Head?
Yes. Do you know what Mr. Potato Head was like when it first launched?
It
was a real potato. You supplied the potato, and all you got were the—
like the lips and the eyes and the feet.
And you'd shove it into a potato.
And then you bake it. And then you eat the melted plastic-covered potato. No.
Yeah. You just, and then you lose a customer for life.
Yeah.
Or to the undeath is what it would be, because you would just become a potato zombie.
Yeah. So his commercials aired during Captain Kangaroo and Howdy Doody and shows like that.
Yeah, exactly. They were specifically geared to shows that kids were watching. So the kids would see the commercials for Silly Putty and then say, Mommy, Daddy, buy me that. And it worked. By the time that Hodgson passed away in 1976, his estate was worth more than $140 million. Not bad for a guy who was apparently out of work when he first got the idea. When he's made this stuff the first time, like for serious, he had to take out a loan of $150 because he didn't have enough money to start up the production costs.
That's a really good return on investment.
Yes, a $150 loan leading to a $140 million estate. Not bad. Yeah. In 1977, a company called Benny and Smith, which also owned Crayola crayons, purchased the rights to Silly Putty, and Benny and Smith still own those rights, although the company changed its name officially to Crayola LLC in 2007.
It's nice that the two top sellers in Fall Gatter's catalog can be together once again.
Yes, reunited, and it feels so good. And today, you can still buy Silly Putty. You can actually buy lots of different variations of Silly Putty, including one that I wish didn't exist. Which one was that, Ariel?
Are you going to make me say it?
Yeah.
It's a poop putty with, like, fake corn kernels in it.
Yeah. It's called Ugly Putty Poop Version, which to me is a terrible, terrible, terrible misnaming. Because you know what I would have called it?
No.
Silly Potty Putty.
Oh, that is more clever. You know what? I understand that you found that painful item and you had to share it with me.
I didn't just share it with her, folks. I sent her a picture of the product.
But I'm going to move on. So Silly Putty does actually have some practical uses.
Yeah, oddly enough, discovered after it was already marketed as a toy. So what are some of those practical uses?
Well, you can use it to remove lint.
Yes, that's actually true. People have used it as a lint remover on clothing. Mm-hmm. That's true. You've ever been to, say, a restaurant and you sit down at the table and it's one of those irritating tables that has one leg slightly the wrong length?
All the time. I'm like the irritating table magnet.
Yeah. So there are people who have used Silly Putty to essentially just, you know, wedge some Silly Putty underneath the wobbly leg to stabilize the table. Practical use.
Just keep a wad in your back pocket and bring it with you to all restaurants. And then it's also used someplace I have never been, which is in space.
Yes, I also have never been to space. I was so amused to hear about this. Yes, people, astronauts in space, have used Silly Putty in order to secure tools to a particular spot inside the spacecraft. Otherwise, they tend to float off. So if you're working with tools on something in space and you want it to be where it was when you dropped it, you stick it against the wall with some Silly Putty because you can just peel the Silly Putty off when you're done. So, yeah, it actually has that practical use too. Now, granted, I would argue that's a very limited use case scenario.
It is. It is. This was a really great story. We're going to talk about something else that was also kind of sticky.
Yep.
Not the poo putty.
And this will be one that Ariel takes the lead on because she did all the research for it. But we'll talk about that in just a second.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.
We went from normal life, healthy child, to acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or B-cell ALL. The St. Jude team came up to get CJ via ambulance. Shortly after that, I noticed a rainbow. It meant that there was hope. We were driving into hope. To have hope is to have your child healthy, and we have that because of St. Jude.
You can help kids fight childhood cancer. Please become a St. Jude Partner in Hope today by visiting musicgives.org.
All right, so we just talked about rubber, so let's talk about some string.
Okay.
All right.
What kind of string?
Silly string.
Silly string.
Yeah.
All right, Ariel, did you know, when I first applied to work at How Stuff Works, one of the articles I got to read early on before it published was How Silly String Works, written by Tracy Wilson.
I didn't know that, but I did read that article.
And you know Tracy.
And I know Tracy.
Yeah, so we both are friends with Tracy. And that was – it's funny because this takes me back to my first year, 2007, with How Stuff Works. So let's talk about Silly String. Where does this come from?
All right. So Silly String was being developed in 1972. And it was being developed by Leonard Fish, who is an inventor, and Robert Cox, who is a chemist.
Mm-hmm.
And like our last two stories, they weren't developing a children's toy.
Okay.
They were trying to create a spray-on cast that would harden in seconds.
Okay, so this is like meant to be
for medical use. Yeah.
So you've broken your arm. You're in some remote location. You may not be anywhere close to medical help, and this would be a way to stabilize a broken limb. Until you could actually get more qualified help.
Exactly.
Cool.
Exactly. The technical patent for it was foamable resinous composition.
I'm pretty sure I wrote a few of those when I was in college.
I'd believe it. And the reason that is because silly string starts as a liquid plastic, which is made of a little acrylic resin, a little surfactant, which is what kind of makes it sticky. It's the same thing that makes your detergent sticky.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and a lot of propellant.
Obviously to push it out of the can. Yeah.
Yeah, which originally was Freon 12.
Mm.
It's been replaced since then because it has been deemed environmentally unsound. It affects the ozone layer.
Gotcha. Yeah. And it's one of those chlorofluorocarbons that we heard about all the time in the late 80s.
Yes. Gotcha. And so when you push it out of the can, it turns into a tacky string-like substance.
Now, when you say tacky, you mean sticky.
Sticky.
Not like, ugh.
Well, I mean, some people would say that silly string is also, ugh.
But that wasn't how it was intended. I mean, you'd be like, ugh, look at that cast you're wearing. It's so tacky.
Yeah, not in the beginning. Gotcha. Anyhow. A little fun fact I want to put in here just because we're talking about how silly string is created. It takes less force to pull the string off a wall than it does to pull the string apart.
Oh. So its stickiness is less strong than its tensile strength.
Yes. You would think, well, this is a foam that comes out of a can, but it's actually sticky plastic string.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
So they created this compound, and then they had to figure out the best way to distribute it. Since it's coming out of a can, they need a nozzle.
Okay. So, yeah. So now they're looking at the practical implementation of this stuff.
And they tried a bunch of nozzles, and they tested their prototype a ton of times. And
I'm in the wrong job, man. I want a job where I'm testing nozzles, different nozzle designs.
I'd imagine it would get boring after a while.
Maybe, but that first day has got to be fun.
Anyhow— the nozzle they landed on because it reliably shot the foam 30 feet across the room in a consistent string
when
formation.
When your friend has broken their leg and you don't want to be anywhere near them.
Like maybe they're covered in ants, which would be a problem because ants would get stuck inside the foam cast.
That's a bad day. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you don't want to get more involved than you have to be in that kind of thing.
But here's the thing.
Okay.
Okay, so Fish looked at this and he went, well, that was really fun. Maybe this shouldn't be a medical thing. Maybe it should be a toy because it's fun.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, so the idea being like, this might not have the practical application we were hoping for when we first set out to do this.
Yeah, they realized they couldn't make a lot of headway in the medical industry, which is a really – I wonder if they were already doubting their concept from the early get-go.
I would imagine that trying to apply this stuff in a way that could have enough surface coverage to be a cast would be a challenge.
Well, especially you'd have to turn the limb to get it all the way around. Or maybe you could spray it on one side like a splint and then—
Yeah, but it wasn't like it was going on like a mist where you could get a lot— because if it's like a thin spray, then it's almost like you're drawing with a pencil, right? You have to do line after line after line after line.
Well, I mean, if you spray silly string, it comes out in a continuous string, so you could just get a giant glob.
That's true.
You could get a giant glob. Anyhow, so they course corrected before it even hit market. And Fish, knowing that he wasn't really a toy mogul, said, I'm going to find a toy company to help me with this.
Ah, perfect. So there he's again, kind of like Al Carter, who said, I don't know how to manufacture on a mass scale. I'm going to need to find someone to bring in. Same sort of approach.
Yes. So Fish went to Huemo.
Huemo.
Huemo. Huemo is a huge toy manufacturer. They sold things like hula hoops, frisbees, slip and slides, all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that same year, in 1972, they were issued the patent for silly string. But it wasn't just a walk-in, here's our product, cool, we love it, let's do it.
Okay, so how did it actually go down?
All right, so Fish and Cox decided the best way to demo the product was to meet with a toy executive at Huemo and then to spray an entire can of this string in the executive's office to demonstrate it. And the executive was really angry and had them escorted off the premise.
Wow. This actually reminds me of another story that I'll tell you off microphone.
Sure. Because
it doesn't have anything to do with this episode, and I'm already tangent man. So let's keep on going. So,
all right.
So it sounds to me like it was a non-starter then because the executive's upset. They get escorted off the premises. They're like, don't come back. So how did things turn around?
Well, some other people went into the office after this executive tried to clean up. There was still some—the story goes there was still some silly string hanging off of his lamp.
Mm-hmm.
And they saw it and they said, what is this stuff? This stuff looks like a lot of fun. So the next day, after all this happened, Fish and Cox got a message for that they Huemo wanted 24 cans of the stuff for basically R&D testing. And
wow.
Then— 2 weeks later, the contract was signed.
Awesome. So I see you've got some interesting like an interesting fact here about Silly String, at least the claim about a can. So tell everybody how much Silly String is in a can of Silly String, according to Wham-O.
According to Wham-O, a quarter of a mile of Silly String is in a can of Silly String, which is impressive considering most of the can is just propellant.
Yes. Yeah. It also makes me think that, you know, if you need a quarter of a mile of stuff in order to set your arm, you really do need to seek medical help.
Yeah. I agree.
Also, don't use Silly String to do that.
Don't.
It won't work and it might burn your skin.
Well, before they sold it as a toy, they did adjust the formula. So it was less sticky and less...
And it wouldn't be it wouldn't harden the same way that the stuff originally was meant to.
I mean, there are still some dangers with it, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But first, while we should do an episode on Wham-O at some point, because they've also gone through a lot as a company, I'm just going to run us through some of the changing of hands that happened.
Okay.
With Wham-O. So in 1982, the owners of Wham-O retired, and they sold the company to Kransko. And then Kransko then sold Wham-O to Mattel in 1994.
Oh, Mattel. Ending up with everything.
They do. Like Silly Putty. Was it Silly Putty?
Magic 8 Ball.
Okay. Like Magic 8 Ball.
Yes.
All right. So then Mattel does some restructuring of the company, including creating a new Wham-O. And they put a bunch of the products into the new Wham-O company. And then they sent some of the products elsewhere. And one of those products was Silly String. Sometime between 1997 and 2001.
Yeah, we love it when we can't nail things down with our sources.
Yeah. Wham-O gave the rights for Silly String to Julius Salmon and the Car Freshener Corporation.
Okay.
Yeah, who then made and distributed Silly String through their toy division, Just for Kicks. So
wait a minute. There's a Car Freshener Corporation that has a toy division?
Yes. But, okay. But okay, so there's conflicting reports. So some say that Car Freshener bought Just for Kicks in 1997, and Just for Kicks was already making Silly String. Other reports say that Wham-O gave the Car Freshener Corporation the patent in 1997 or in 1999. And then the official Silly String website says they've been manufacturing millions and millions of cans out of their manufacturing facility in DeWitt, Iowa since 2001. It's hard to pinpoint because Just for Kicks doesn't have their own website and isn't even mentioned on the littletrees.com website, which is the car air fresheners that Car Freshener Corporation makes.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. But
so what we're hearing is there's a shadow organization making Silly String.
But we do know that Car Freshener Organization, Car Freshener Corporation is the parent company that currently owns Silly String.
Okay.
It is on the Silly String website.
Gotcha.
All right. So in 2006, a few American companies got in trouble for selling imported Silly String, mainly coming out of China.
So these are knockoff products, essentially.
Yes, because they had propellants that had been banned.
Mm.
So they got confiscated and destroyed in a way that wouldn't hurt the environment.
Right. Yeah. Just thrown into a basement with a bunch of bored kids.
Yeah. Now— That's so mean. It took me a second. That's mean.
I know, because you thought Jonathan just added something material to this podcast, and then you realized, no, he did not.
I mean, I really do listen to your comments, Jonathan.
Yeah. They just don't sink in until about 30 seconds later.
I'm like a brontosaurus. It takes a while for signals to get to my brain. Anyhow, despite the fact that American Silly String doesn't have a lot of these—
Dangerous
propellants. It is still dangerous. Some of the other propellants they use other than Freon 12 can do things like catch on fire or can get too cold and freeze your skin.
Oof.
Yeah, so even allowable cans of Silly String have warnings on them. But they also are banned in certain cities for being otherwise environmentally unsound. They're hard to clean up. They can clog storm drains.
They can be used by jerkwads to totally, like, vandalize a property.
They can go into the ocean. They don't break down quickly.
Mm.
Again, vandals. I'm guessing that might be a real big reason behind it. Like, it's hard to clean up. You don't want Silly String stuck to your street forever, but—
No, one of the things I think is really interesting here is that you have a note that Silly String has found practical uses in some very serious applications, like— You wouldn't think of it with the name Silly String, but it's been used to help military operations.
Yeah, so like Silly Putty, this does have practical applications. Some stories say as early as the Vietnam War, we're not exactly sure when silly string became a thing to use. But apparently people have been using it for a while. In the military, people spray it in areas where they think there might be tripwires or booby traps or bombs because the string is sturdy enough to not break when it hits the wire.
So then it drapes across and it shows mm-hmm. you where the wire is.
Yes, but it's not heavy enough to actually trip the wire.
Mm.
And this really made really big news in 2006, 2007, because there was a young soldier who wrote to his mom for a couple cans of silly string. And when she found out what he needed them for, she's like, I'm going to send him a whole bunch of cans of silly string. And then she couldn't send them because the U.S. Post has restrictions on sending
stuff that has like
hazardous materials. Yeah, in the mail. And so they ended up with a stockpile of 80,000 cans in New Jersey.
Wow.
Yeah. And some were donated by Just for Kicks.
The company that makes it.
Yes. Eventually, they did find somebody who could ship them to Iraq where this soldier was. So Silly String is still around. The company that technically is distributing, making it now, is Silly String Products.
But that's part of the Car Freshener Corporation.
Yes. Yes. And they're based out of Waterton, New York. I don't know why I said that like that. And they're based out of Waterton, New York.
Wow. So that is also a story that I had read about how it works, but I hadn't really read too much into the history of it. So this is all really fascinating to me. And again, it shows how people can take lemons and make lemonade on a big business scale.
And if your lemonade doesn't sell?
Maybe you sell it as a skin cleanser.
To a child.
Or maybe as mace. Who knows? But yeah, no, this was cool because I think the lessons, when you say lessons learned, like mm-hmm. the lesson here is you don't necessarily just accept failure as failure. You look to see where opportunities are. Now, those opportunities may just be learn from your mistakes so that you don't repeat them.
There are certainly times you need to move on.
Yeah. And then there are other times where you may think, well, I set out to go for goal A. This did not achieve goal A, but it may turn out that this could be a stepping stone to goal B, which is equally valid. And I can still go after goal A later on if I want to. But if I use this, I can actually use it as a way to earn revenue as opposed to it just being a total loss. And again, obviously that's not applicable in every situation, but it does remind us to reevaluate when we fail.
Yeah.
And to say, first of all, this isn't the end of the world. Second of all, what can we learn from this? Is there anything that we can salvage from this or even just apply this to the next attempt? So I think that is a really fun way to do it. Like we picked three sort of light and silly. Now, silly was in the name of two of the different products.
Well, I'm going to start calling it a silly magic eight ball now.
A silly magic, just so we can have a nice, a nice collective there. But yes, this was a lot of fun. Now, we'll probably occasionally do little one-off episodes like this where we step outside of our normal profile of a specific business at a specific time. But we'll be going back to that tried and true formula because that is what the show is mainly about. But yes, if you have any ideas for things similar to this that you would like for a very silly episode of Business on the Brink, or even not silly, but just some outside of our norm, you should send us an email. Where can they do that, Ariel?
Well, Jonathan, they can do that at feedback@thebrinkpodcast.show.
That's right. And you can also visit our website. That's also thebrinkpodcast.show, where you will find an archive of all of our past episodes and information about your lovable hosts, such as me. I have been Jonathan Strickland.
And me. I've been Ariel Kasten.
Bye.
Business on the Brink is a production of iHeartRadio and How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.